From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. When you suffer from insomnia, the middle of the night is a harrowing place. As F. Scott Fitzgerald said, quote, "The worst thing in the world is to try to sleep and not to," end quote. Insomnia is all too familiar for many of us, but repeated efforts to fall asleep can actually make things worse.
By this point, you've had a lot of practice at being a lousy sleeper, and you've gotten very good at it. So the insomnia takes on a life of its own.
Dr. Emerson Wickwire, director of the Insomnia Program at the University of Maryland Medical Center, joins us to talk about the causes of this maddening affliction and how best to summon this news. It's on the record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. We're talking today about a late-night demon with which many of us are all too familiar, insomnia. Perhaps you have a chronic case, or maybe you're suffering from a temporary bout brought on by work stress or holiday season anxiety. Either way, insomnia can have devastating effects on one's mental and physical health. And here to tell us about the causes of and remedies for chronic sleeplessness is Dr. Emerson Wickwire, director of the Insomnia Program at the University of Maryland Midtown Medical Center. He's also assistant professor of psychiatry and medicine. Welcome to On the Record.
So glad to be here.
It's good to see you again. What qualifies as insomnia?
So we think about a 30-minute threshold, either 30 minutes to fall asleep, being awake for a total of 30 minutes in the middle of the night, occurring three nights per week or more for a duration of 3 months or more. Now, these complaints need to be associated with a daytime consequence, which of course run the gamut. For some patients, that may be irritability or difficulty concentrating or even somatic bodily pain kinds of issues, irritable bowel or headaches, for example. The range of daytime consequences is very, very broad.
How common is insomnia?
On any given night, 30 to 40% of U.S. adults are having a poor night sleeping. Now, for most folks, those poor nights of sleep wither away, if you will, and healthy sleep returns. The causes of poor night's sleep could be anything from a distressing conversation at work or with your spouse, or maybe you have a cold and you're tossing and turning on that given night. But for roughly 10 to 15% of the U.S. adult population, that develops into a chronic problem. What we tell patients is that regardless of what originally caused the insomnia, by this point, you've had a lot of practice at being a lousy sleeper and you've gotten very good at it. So the insomnia takes on a life of its own.
You just did a study, the financial cost of insomnia.
We've been doing a lot of work. In fact, we've just received a very exciting 2-year grant. We know that patients who have sleeping troubles consume more healthcare resources. So from a public health perspective, learning to reduce those costs and identifying the treatments that most effectively, on the one hand, improve patient outcomes and quality of life, and on the other hand, benefit the overall health system by reducing utilization, these are major public health priorities.
Tell me more about the causes of insomnia.
Ironically, nearly anything could be a cause. This could be something overtly traumatic, if you will. Loss of a loved one, dissolution of a romantic relationship, job transition, or losing your job. Certainly in the past several years, a great number of people have felt acute financial stress. Slightly less than half of the time, we're able to identify an acute trigger like that. There could be a combat trauma, for example. I do a great deal of work with the Department of Defense and soldiers, and certainly trauma-related insomnia is a major issue within the military that we are actively working to solve. But again, once we have that shift from acute sleep disturbance to chronic sleep problem, the original cause is far less important. And the reason, Sheila, is this. When you're having trouble sleeping, you begin to do things like sleep in on the weekends or take naps or be less active during the day. Maybe you no longer go to the gym. Maybe you do things like chronically using over-the-counter sleep medications or even chronically using prescription sleep medications. In the short term, all of these compensatory strategies make you feel better. The problem is that in the long term, when that original stressor dies down, these compensatory behaviors are what perpetuate the insomnia.
That is Dr. Emerson Wickwire, director of the Insomnia Program at the University of Maryland Midtown Medical Center, here on The Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about what's behind insomnia and what to do about it. You didn't mention things like caffeine or nicotine, alcohol. Are those triggers?
Certainly, caffeine and nicotine are stimulants, and these can absolutely disrupt sleep. Alcohol, on the other hand, will help you fall asleep faster. But alcohol is both a respiratory depressant, so it can cause obstructive sleep apnea, which is a disorder of breathing during sleep, because alcohol makes the muscles in the back of your throat relax. So this is why people, after they've had a few drinks, they snore even if they don't normally snore. In addition to impairing your breathing, it also changes what we call sleep architecture. So alcohol will help you fall asleep faster, there's no question, but then after that, everything else about your sleep is not so hot. So if you think about this at a cultural level, many Americans are sedating themselves to try and get some sleep at night by using alcohol or over-the-counter sleep aids, and then they're stimulating themselves by, let's say, overusing caffeine during the day.
How does insomnia affect mood?
There is no question that there is a robust relationship between trouble sleeping and mood. Insomnia is often a warning sign or a harbinger of pending depression. Trouble sleeping doesn't only increase depressed mood. Mood has two components. There's depressed mood, if you will, or negative mood, but there's also positive mood. And what trouble sleeping does in particular is it diminishes positive mood. So yes, it increases feelings of sadness, but often what it does is it decreases your ability to identify with and take in the good, if you will. Even in healthy people, if we put them through an experimental research protocol and manipulate their sleep, we see very, very quickly these kinds of cognitive and emotional changes. There was a fascinating study done just across town at Hopkins Bayview several years ago. This was a study among burn victims. So these were folks who had 30 to 40% of their body burned. It's a serious and life-threatening trauma. And what they did is they tracked these patients from the time that they were hospitalized through their discharge and six-month follow-up. And they assessed things like sleep and pain at these different points in time. And what the researchers found was that the severity of sleep disturbance during my acute hospitalization was a stronger predictor of pain down the road than burn severity. That's very profound if you think about it.
Yeah, one thinks of a burn as the worst kind of pain you could have. And the idea that sleep disturbance would be a bigger factor going forward is kind of amazing. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm speaking with Dr. Emerson Wickwire, director of the Insomnia Program at the University of Maryland Medical Center. We have to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk some more about chronic sleeplessness and especially what can be done about it. Stay with us.
On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. This is Sheila Cass. Today we're talking about an affliction that affects far too many of us, insomnia. My guest is Dr. Emerson Wickwire, director of the Insomnia Program at the University of Maryland Medical Center. Does the remedy for insomnia depend on the cause, or are there remedies for anyone who has an insomnia problem?
When we think about treating insomnia, there are generally two kinds of factors. There are external factors and there are internal factors. An external factor might be creating a sacred environment for sleep, creating a sacred bedroom environment where really only sleep should take place. And many of your listeners will have heard that the bedroom should only be used for sleep or sex.
No TV.
No TV.
No reading.
Exactly. Now, if you have been enjoying reading for 30 years before you fall asleep and you don't have a problem, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. However, by the time folks end up in my office, we're now interested in addressing all the possible contributing factors to make sure that we can improve sleep as much as possible. The bedroom environment should be cool, dark, quiet, and uncluttered. And really what we're working to do here is to repair the act of getting in bed with falling asleep quickly and staying asleep. I saw a patient yesterday morning, wonderful man, very successful professionally, and he awakens between 60 and 90 minutes each morning earlier than he would like to. So he fights and wants to fall back asleep. And if you think about that, you're practicing having insomnia in bed, and practice makes permanent. So we want to be sure that the time we spend in bed is really optimal sleep time so that, again, we can overcome that habitual sleeping pattern.
So the patient's waking up way earlier than he needs to. What did you tell him?
I told him to get up and start his day. That if he crossed a threshold where he was pretty sure that he was no longer going to be able to fall back asleep, that the best thing to do is to get up and start the day. Now, there are two benefits that happen when we do that. The first, as I mentioned, is that he's no longer practicing having insomnia. He's no longer digging that ditch more deeply. The second thing is that the following night, he's probably going to be a little bit sleepier. It's going to make his next night of sleep a little bit better. Now, sometimes patients ask, well, what happens if I wake up at 2:30 in the night?
That's just what I was about to ask you.
So we need to use our judgment a little bit. Absolutely, we want to avoid that time awake in bed. So if it's 2:30 and I'm confident that I'm not going to fall back asleep, I strongly discourage you from watching the clock. I want you to turn the clock around and instead just trust your gut. If you're awake and you're not going to fall back asleep, get out of bed, avoid stimulating activities, and wait and see if sleepiness returns. The goal of this component of a behavioral treatment is to repair the act of getting in bed with falling asleep quickly and staying asleep. What that means is that I need to be highly confident that I'm going to fall asleep when I get in bed. So if it's 2:30, it's perfectly okay to return to bed when you're sleepy. If it's 4:30 or 5, depending on what time you awaken, use your judgment. It might be time to start the day. That might be the most helpful thing you can do.
And if you're just having a very hard time falling asleep on a regular basis, should you also get up at that point at 11:30 at night?
It depends. One of the things that we see very frequently is that patients are living their lives at 60,000 feet. In other words, they're very active. They have busy families. They have work demands. They're busy. And what we need to do is to move from living at 60,000 feet to living at 30,000 feet in that wind down period before bed. The goal is never to lower the bar and be less engaged or less productive during your life. But if you try and land on a short runway from 60,000 feet, you miss the runway. So we need to have that pre-sleep wind down, which is one of the most enjoyable times of day once we learn how to incorporate it into our lives.
What is the first step that someone who's experiencing insomnia should take?
Assess your current sleep patterns and how these are interacting with lifestyle factors or with your daily life routine. That means that we're going to ask you to keep what's called a sleep log or a sleep diary when we're talking about insomnia. It's a 60-second a day. Let's take a look at your sleep patterns. How long is it taking you to fall asleep? Are you drinking caffeine or alcohol? Are you taking medications? If so, at what time? Once you've fallen asleep, how many times do you awaken during the night? How long does it take you to fall back asleep? What time do you wake up in the morning? What time do you get out of bed? How refreshed did you feel? So medicine works in three stages. There's assessment and diagnosis and prescription. And the first thing that we need to do is make sure we have a thorough assessment so we can have an accurate diagnosis.
So it sounds like there will be things in that log that I, as a layperson who's caught up in this, am not going to spot as a problem. It really takes an expert.
There are certainly things that patients do see, and it's very rewarding when a patient comes in and says, you know, I actually realized that every day that I had a coffee at 4 in the afternoon, those tended to be my worst nights. Now, that's an oversimplified example. But the purpose of that is to bring both of us on the same page about, hey, here's our starting point. Here's the way things are currently.
At what point should a person turn to medication?
That is an excellent and even somewhat controversial question. There are hardliners, if you will, who really don't think that sleep medications have any place in insomnia treatment or only in severe cases. There are others who probably prescribe sleep medications a little bit too loosely. I think that the preference for non-drug therapies and sleep medications is ultimately a personal one between a patient and his or her provider. That being said, there are major bodies of experts who all recommend non-drug therapies as the first-line treatment approach for chronic insomnia.
What's an example of a non-drug therapy?
There may be a mindfulness-based approach for insomnia. The broad category with which we think about these interventions are called behavioral treatments or cognitive behavioral treatments for insomnia. At the University of Maryland Medical Center, for example, we administer not only mindfulness-based therapies, but also traditional cognitive behavioral treatments for insomnia. That's a fancy way of saying that we teach patients how to sleep.
Does insurance tend to cover interventions like this?
It does. We have an integrated practice model. So I'm a psychologist by training, but really a sleep disorder specialist. I'm an expert in the non-drug treatments of sleep disorders. And that means that I don't do a physical exam. I don't prescribe medications. What I do is much closer to executive coaching than the stereotypical psychology or psychotherapy that you might see on The Sopranos, for example. So I always work in conjunction with one of my MD colleagues, which is really in our patient's best interest.
The hormone melatonin is available over the counter without a prescription. It's, I guess, a pretty popular sleep aid. Do you recommend it?
It depends what for. And this is why it's so important to have accurate diagnosis. Sheila, when patients come to see us, oftentimes they think that the problem is insomnia or they think that the problem is snoring, and they may have no idea that the problem is actually both. That's a very, very common situation. So when we think about melatonin, it's worth stepping back and saying, okay, well, what does melatonin do? Melatonin is a naturally produced hormone. It's secreted by the pineal gland in the center of your brain, essentially, and it tells your body that it's dark outside. It does not work like Ambien or over-the-counter sleep aids that make you sleepy and help you fall asleep. Now, at very high doses, melatonin will induce some grogginess, and there are risks associated with taking melatonin. You need to be very careful about next day driving and so forth. But what melatonin is great for is regulating what we call circadian rhythmicity or the sleep schedule. So when patients have shift work problems or if adolescents experience what we call a delayed sleep phase, everyone has a teenager or knows a teenager who wanted to go to bed at 5 in the morning and sleep till 5 in the afternoon, melatonin can be very helpful for those kinds of problems. But in general, if folks are having trouble falling asleep or staying asleep, melatonin is probably not your most effective first step.
What are your thoughts about herbal remedies like kava kava?
In general, I'm all for integrated approaches, as long as we've very carefully assessed and diagnosed. There's a great deal of misdiagnosis in sleep medicine in particular. Oftentimes, accurate diagnosis really does require an expert.
How has the thinking about treating insomnia changed over the years, or recent years?
Certainly the shift away from pharmacotherapy is the only answer. In other words, if I'm having trouble sleeping, give me a sleeping pill. that's probably the single biggest transition in managing insomnia over the past 10 or 20 years.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Kast, speaking with Dr. Emerson Wickwire, director of the Insomnia Program at the University of Maryland Medical Center. Mobile technology, cell phones, tablets, have they led to more insomnia?
For two reasons. The most obvious is that the technology behind mobile devices involves blue emitting lights. Now, earlier we spoke briefly about melatonin and circadian rhythmicity. Blue light in particular is a very, very powerful melatonin suppressant. So melatonin tells your body that it's dark outside, your core temperature begins to cool. This is how the groundwork is laid for you to fall asleep at night. And blue light suppresses melatonin. So there was recently a study published from Harvard using e-readers. And very, very clearly this demonstrates that if your retinas are exposed to blue light, which is light in particular wavelength spectrums before bed, it will suppress melatonin and make it more difficult for you to fall asleep, which then, of course, truncates the amount of sleep you're getting, and that's really where many of the difficulties we were talking about earlier come from.
Is insomnia more common now than it was a decade ago?
That's a very good question. It's difficult to answer. I think that we're very busy. We are busy. We are connected. In addition to blue light, you asked about mobile devices. In my experience in speaking with thousands of individuals about their sleep, one of the things that mobile devices do is they keep us always connected. And sleep is a period of disconnection. So sleep, we want to take place not only in a sacred space, as I mentioned earlier, but also in a sacred time. And the more that I'm connected electronically, the more difficult it is to fully disconnect, even neurophysiologically.
So you're saying even if these devices were not emitting blue light, they'd be working against healthy sleep.
That's right. What do we use our electronic devices for? We generally use these for things that either activate the decision-making centers in the brain. In other words, these are activate the frontal cortex, which is inconsistent with sleep, or these are stress cues. People are checking the stocks or reading the political news. I've talked with, as I mentioned, many, many folks about their sleep, and I've never met one for whom the news was relaxing.
So what do you recommend then as a realistic way for sleep to coexist with technology?
The first thing is that we need to be mindful of this and aware of the role that technology is playing in our lives. The second is that we need to begin to create boundaries, however gentle they are, to separate sleep as a protected time from our waking lives. So think about dusk. The sun is bright and we are active during the day, the sun begins to go down, and there's a period of transition. There is a dusk each day before the sun rises the following morning. We need to create more dusk in our lives, creating purposeful, powerful, very positive, in other words, enjoyable pre-sleep routines. And at a certain point, we need to leave our smartphones in the kitchen, or we need to power those down.
Give me an example of a pre-sleep routine that people find useful.
I'm going to do that by asking three questions. First, what do you do when you first get home during the day? Do you disengage or do you engage further? What are your last stress cues? Second, when do you change your clothes and how purposefully do you change your clothes? Do you stay in your professional garb up until the very last minute? Or maybe do you change into your blue jeans and a comfortable sweater and begin to create a ritual where we are leaving some of our daytime stress behind. The third thing is, what are you focusing on in the 30, 60, 90 minutes before bed? Are you focusing on stressful things or are you focusing on the kinds of things for which you're grateful? We talked about sleep and mood earlier. Focusing on the positive aspects of our lives can improve our sleep and improve our overall quality of life as well.
If you have a sleep problem and if you live with a partner, is there a role a partner can play in solving this?
I would be delighted if every patient who ever came to see me brought his or her bed partner with them. It's important for several reasons. The bed partner can often provide helpful insight that the patient can't, even if the bed partner is often asleep. We'll have two sets of eyes on the problem, if you will, or three sets of eyes on the problem if I'm in the room. Now, the second thing is that treating sleep disorders in a way that facilitates long-term change, in other words, it's not a quick fix, but we're actually going to leverage the power of sleep to improve the quality of your life in the long run, is going to involve you doing some things differently. Bed partners can be huge allies if they understand why we're going to experiment with some of the changes that I might suggest.
Snoring may not bother the partner who's doing it, but it may bother the other partner. How do you handle that?
If during our conversation today, if I were snoring, I were awake, but just snoring, you wouldn't think that we're normal. Snoring is a warning sign. Somehow we've been duped into believing or underestimating that during sleep, snoring is okay. Snoring occurs because there isn't enough space in the upper airway for air to move through. It is at least a somewhat reliable indicator for obstructive sleep apnea, a sleep disorder with relatively severe consequences ranging from increased risk for stroke and heart attack and diabetes and premature death. Snoring is a warning sign. It shouldn't be ignored.
So much to talk about. I really appreciate your walking us through it. Thank you.
Delighted to be here.
Dr. Emerson Rickwire is Assistant Professor of Psychiatry and Medicine and Director of the Insomnia Program at the University of Maryland Medical Center. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Kest. I hope you have a pleasant day and a restful night. Tune in tomorrow. Now I lay me-